love you. But you don't have to please me. You really don't. You don't want to do what I do? That's fine with me. I can still be your friend. Please don't try to please me. You'll fail. And I do my best not to try to please you, because I'll fail. If we came here this weekend, Jerry and I, with expectations of what you wanted, we would fail miserably. We don't have a clue yet, and it's 11:30 on Saturday. We still don't know. But apparently, whatever it is we're doing is what you wanted, because you're still here. Okay? I don't do format things, because never mind. Okay? I don't even believe that I have to please God. I believe God is pleased. Period. If I have to please him, he's a mean, vindictive creature I can't believe in anyway. He must be mighty pleased with me because he came into my life at the bottom, not the top. I had broken every single rule I'd ever heard he made. Of course, I've since discovered he didn't make any. But I thought he had. The only thing I haven't done is covet my neighbor's manservant or something like that. But, well, my neighbors didn't have men servants. How could I do that? So my experience is that at my worst is when I'm most acceptable. He must be pleased ahead of time. I don't have to please God. He's already pleased, I expect. So why should you have to please me? Or why should I have to please you? That just gets in the way of us getting to know each other. I'm not always pleasant. And neither are you. No lectures to be endured. That's a damn shame because I love to lecture. I get to do that for a living, so that takes care of that. But there's no lectures to be endured. If you don't want to finish this day, you can get up and go. There's no AA police to stop you. There's nobody at the door to say, oh, you got to stay. You got to hear this. No, you don't. If I don't feel like hanging around, I can go. It's true. These are the conditions we found most effective. Does that fit me? There's a good, just a touchstone for my life in AA. I have a tendency to like to go out to other groups, and if I go trolling, it's fine. I go to other groups just to mention that here's how I did it, and here's the results I got, in case somebody isn't getting enough. I have a tendency to want to go in there and change those groups. They took that out of me a while back. They just won't change. I ended up down in North Carolina a couple of years ago, and I have told all, Denver produces missionaries. I don't know if you understand that, because Denver's a big book town. If you do this, you will become a missionary. You don't have any choice. You will be on a mission. That's all a missionary is. You are now filled with the Spirit of God, and that gives you a mission. You've got to go tell somebody about it just as soon as possible. And you know where they are? In the group that you don't like most. That's where they are. That's right. Anyway, I ended up down in North Carolina, and I've told these guys, like Jerry, just become part of whatever's there, and God will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. I'm sicker than most of the folks, and I need more. Okay, so I got to North Carolina, and at the time I went, I was 2 months into interferon. Hepatitis had taken me out of the game. And we were working to either fix this thing or die. It wasn't comfortable. No great drama in it. I didn't feel good. And we all have messengers. If you're on this path, you are going to hear certain people clearly. And you will follow them anywhere. And Tom Ivester is one of those for me. And I had told some people years before, I hope Tom never asked me to go to work for him because I'll just drop everything and go. Well, he asked me. And I called my wife and said, what do you think? And she says, well, you can't not go. So in the midst of hepatitis, in the midst of treatment for that, I left home, my group, my family, all of my support. You know, it comes to that. Please know that. Eventually, it's just me and God. And I had to go to a place where they really don't speak English. They speak pure Southern down there. Lovely people. But they eat salt and grease. Oh yeah, breakfast is pig fat covered with pig fat gravy. First time I had red eye gravy and country ham, almost died of shock. My heart went, ooh! That's just the background. So, you know, I trusted in God entirely. I knew I had this to do. I was given a job that was vastly beyond me, and my wife will tell you that because of that, it saved my life. This was at a time when there were mornings I could not tie my shoes. I didn't have the strength. I'd tie one and couldn't tie the other. I was tired. And I had to supervise alcohol and drug programs in 15 penitentiaries. That was my new job. And because of that, because I could not do it, I had to rely on God just for the strength to get out of bed. It saved my life. But I went to that group, and they weren't doing it right. This was the Southern Pines Big Book Group, best group in North Carolina, and they weren't doing it right. My God, they had a chip system that drove me crazy. At the beginning of the meeting, they had this whole rack of chips, and there was a silver chip, and this is how you join AA, come forward and get it. And I thought, my God, that's an altar call. And I'm going, and we had four meetings, and three of them used the 12 and 12, and one of them used the big book. But when I went to the big book meeting, they started to read from the family afterwards and began a discussion on dysfunctional family. And but I kept my mouth shut. I'm spiritually cool. Till the night that the chairperson asked me if I'd hand out the chips, if I would be the chipmunk. I lost it. I said, there are two things I will not do in this group. One of them is hand out chips, and the other is participate in that damn book raffle after the meeting. Because they raffle books after the meeting. And if you ever want to know why, I said, I'll tell you. And this other kid who's standing there said, I want to know why. And then very unkindly, I told him why. And went home with a heart full of pain. You know, one of the things about my life today is I know instantly when I'm an asshole. And I went home and I looked, by using this, at why their chip system and their 12 and 12 and their way of doing things threatened me. Well, it's because I was dependent upon you, not God. Upon people who understood me and the way we do things. And I'd become locked once again on the mechanism and not the spirit. And the only way I could make amends the next week, I had to go to this little 19-year-old girl who'd asked me to hand out chips and request the privilege of being the chipmunk. And I went through the whole litany. And they used to say, this is how you join AA. And I told them my experience with it. This won't keep you sober, not for a minute. But it's a nice memento of the first night you showed up here and made a decision. You know that night nobody took chips? Nobody. There weren't even any birthday chips. And then I went to they had a meeting on steps 4 through 12 out of the 12 and 12. So I went. And they would read the 12 and 12, and I learned some things. When it came time for me to share, I had to share my experience as I had it from this book. And I'd share my experience, and pretty soon people would say, where did you get that? And I always ask, would you like me to show you? And if they said yes, I'd just take them over and show them where I got that. And the next thing you know, I got a couple people to sponsor. And pretty soon, it was decided that we would have a meeting before the meeting where anybody who wanted to go through the big book would go through the big book. And God began to show me how to build this fellowship around me. And I became a member of the group. They never asked me to hand out chips again. I was no good at it. And I made peace with the raffle. I don't believe in raffles. I don't think we need to do fundraising or raising. Same thing. But they did this after the meeting. It had nothing to do with AA. It was a separate outside thing. And I just don't like raffles, but I like the people. So I became the person who pulled the numbers out of the hat. I was the only neutral one in the whole room. I didn't care who won. I didn't care if anybody won. I just liked the people. In the midst of that process, you need to understand that for 30 years I have lived with a sense of the presence of God, where I am, God is. It's just there. I woke up one morning in the middle of all this, and it wasn't there. And I don't know why it didn't frighten me. It didn't. But I have a habit. I began at once to pray. I don't get up in the morning until I've done my first conversation with God. I don't even open my eyes. And in that morning's conversation, which I think is funny because if it wasn't there, who was I talking to? But the prayer was very simple. I need to know you're here. I need to be closer to you. I need to know you better. And my phone rang. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. And there was a fellow named Billy. And Billy said, look, I was 7 years sober last week and I drank. And Alan is 12 years sober and he drank. And we got another member of our group that's getting ready to drink. And the guys tell us, they were from some little town in North Carolina, said, Steve and those guys tell us that every now and then you'll get together with people over a weekend and go through the big book with them. And they don't seem to drink again. Would you do that for us? And I said, sure, Billy, because that's another habit I have. Sure, Billy. And I started to get ready to go to work, and the phone rang. And I'm in the middle of shaving, and the phone rang. And I'm getting a little irritated. I'm busy looking for God, and the damn phone's ringing. Okay. And I finally heard the voice. Because the phone was ringing, and he was saying to me, if you would know me better, get to know my children better. You want to be with me, be with my people. Okay. And it changed my life again. Yes, I believe in our process, but it's absolutely useless without the human contact. Okay. The fellowship grows as a result of me needing you, not you needing me. I need people to tell the stuff that happened to me. From the time I was little, all I ever wanted to do was stand on the street corner and tell people how much I love my God. And I quit doing that after a while because they laugh at you. Now look at me. People put me on airplanes and bring me to where they are so I can tell them how much I love my God. They not only encourage it, they insist on it. Please do the same thing. Those are all little things that will happen along the way. These happened to me when I was 26 years sober, 25 years sober. They'll happen all the way along the way. I have to let go sometimes of what I know about this book in order to know about this book. Okay? I have become a worshiper of process sometimes and become useless. None of us makes the sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. We feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. See, that's our real message. This isn't about sobriety. I think the worst thing in the world I can promise any new drunk is sobriety. One of the reasons I drink is because I can't stand sobriety. True. Can't stand it. It's too painful. Sobriety with purpose, sobriety with meaning. The elimination of drinking is necessary, but it's only a beginning. Do I have more to offer than that? If I don't, I better leave you alone because I'll hurt you if that's all I have for you. We have a common solution. We're about to leave alcohol behind, and we're not even halfway through the book. Okay? This, I contend that the step process will not get you sober. You got to be sober before you can even enter into it. But you can come here drunk and get your hope. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. I love AA, and I love to go to meetings, but I'm only willing to go to maybe one a day, and sometimes not that. I got 23 hours a day when I need to be living in the world. Gary told me one time, I had 7 children, and I'm a sucker for kids. And he said, we have to practice these principles at home too, Don. And in order to do that, you have to be there once in a while and put me on another path. Okay? I can't practice the principles at home if I'm not home. My lovely wife helps me along the way. Sometimes I get to bring her with me on these deals. And she loves to come, but she reminds me this doesn't count as a weekend at home. Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't know that. We're together. What the hell? Okay. No. Being together and being together at home are two completely different deals. We're still dating. I still court her. Took her to the movies the other day. Took her to see Zorro, because I know what that does to women. Okay. I cook on the weekends. As some of you know, if the group's small enough, I'll cook for you Sunday morning. It's my job. Cooking is one of the nicest things you can do for anybody. Feeding them is. That's a true act of love, even if the food's no good. Okay? Yeah. I make the finest French toast on the planet. I say that without any hesitation whatsoever. I've stopped making it because most of you are not worthy. It's time to eat. Have fun with all this. The demonstration of our principles is far more important to the world. The reason Alcoholics Anonymous grew is that the world watches us. And they saw the restoration of family. And they saw the restoration of decency. I hear in meetings sometimes, I didn't come here to get good, I came here to get well. I buy that. But why not get good at the same time? Meaning, why not put forth an image that's trustworthy? Do you know why the doctors send people to us at the beginning? They could trust us. Would you send somebody to AA today? Some of you told me, no, you wouldn't. Isn't that a shame? And I believe if I won't do that, shame on me. Okay? Why wouldn't I? I don't have any problem sending anybody even to the group that I won't go to. They're not going to hurt them any. Okay? And last time I did that, I thought, well, you hypocrite, you're going to send somebody someplace you won't go? Shame on you. More better you take them there. And if it is one of those meetings where there's nothing going on, they'll know it. And then we can talk on the way home about what's really, really important, right? Shit. We're funny. Let's go eat. Helping new people discover whether they are or are not alcoholics is... Helping new people discover whether they are or are. Let's go eat. Helping new people discover whether they are or are not alcoholics is a major part of what we do. There is a difference between alcoholism and other kinds of drug addiction. And I can't help anybody discover whether they're a drug addict or not, because I'm not. Just using drugs doesn't make you a drug addict. Just using alcohol doesn't make you an alcoholic. We can help people discover whether they're alcoholic or not, and that's part of my job. We could spend this entire weekend discussing how to do that. Y'all are experts. I have to pray constantly about where we're going to go with this. There is not enough time, ever, to get it all done. It just isn't. But we're going to have our experience with it. And part of what's coming to me is very strong. We need to do some things around the fourth and fifth step, around the sixth and seventh step, around the eighth and ninth step. The first 50-some-odd pages of this book are redundant as hell. They say the same thing over and over and over again to make damn sure that none of us get missed. The essence of alcoholism is simple. At some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his alcohol consumption once he starts. Once I start, I can't stop. I've lost control. I have no more choice, however you want to put it. If I have a drink, I will have another drink. And all the stuff that follows from that follows from that. That's the one symptom we all have in common. That I can't stop once I start, and I can't seem to keep from starting. Now, while we share a lot of experience, I will tell you that I think, for me, experience is a very poor teacher. I don't learn from it. I almost died the first night I drank from acute alcohol poisoning because I drank too much. Anybody who drank as much and got as sick as I did that first night would never drink again, I promise you. But I'm alcoholic. Bonded bourbon did that to me, so I've never had bonded bourbon since. I drank everything else, and if that's all I could have gotten a hold of, I'd have had bonded bourbon. Okay. If you are alcoholic, you may be suffering from a condition which only a spiritual experience will overcome. Maybe. If you still think that you can handle it by yourself, good luck. If you find another method that works better than this, please tell me about it. Okay, because I do run into people that this doesn't work for, and I no longer say it's because they don't work it. I don't know why the hell they don't get it. They just don't get it. And I'd like to have something else to offer them. But it works for me pretty good. And it's based on having had a spiritual awakening and that power that did it. So that's all this is about for me. So if I talk about that all the time, that's all I know about. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind. See, if I don't drink, I won't have that craving for another drink. So why do I keep drinking? Because I know that's going to happen. I was in my first federal penitentiary when I was 19 because I had a drink, which caused me to do things that put me in a penitentiary. And all I did for 23 days was drink. That's what it was all about. When the madness was gone, I went back and faced the consequences. The main problem the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than the body, because somewhere in my mind to this day, there's a danger zone. I have no more choice over whether I drink today than I did 30 years ago. I've lost the power of choice. It's gone forever. Thank God. Every time I had the choice, I made the wrong one. So my main problem centers in my mind. And I can't use my mind to solve my mind. You can't solve the problem with the problem. Okay? And I come to you and I listen to you for a while. I'm not solving my problem with your mind either. I listen to you talk and I think just exactly like you do. And I'm not risking my life on something that nebulous. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, we still don't know why, have lost the power of choice and drink. It's gone. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. To this day, that's true for me. I have no effective mental defense against the first drink. I don't drink because drinking is no longer my business. It's God's business. And apparently he wants me sober. I've got to count on that. Relate a little something to you. I'm concerned because those of us with some genuine long-term sobriety, anything over 6 months, that's long-term sobriety for an alcoholic. But people with substantial continuous sobriety, I believe, because I am, are in more danger of drinking from the truth than we are from drinking from lies. You're going to be hard-pressed to come up with enough lies to convince me it's okay for me to drink. You really are. I've tried them all out. Okay. But I had an experience about, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years ago, something like that, that brought home to me why I must rely upon God and no other source. I was in an airplane coming back from New York, as a matter of fact. I'd been here for the conference of some kind. Evening flight. And because I fly so much, United Airlines sometimes will put me up in first class just because there's a seat available and they need the cheap seat I've got in the back. And they had bumped me up. The conference had been good. I'm in fit spiritual condition. I'm reading a book I like. The room is warm, if you will. It had ambiance. I just learned that. Up in first class, they use real plates, not plastic. Real forks. It was cool. The light was coming down. Everything was right. I'm headed home to the wife I love. Everything was fine. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw the flight attendant pour this burgundy red stuff into this guy's glass. That's all it was. I looked at it, and the light was hitting it, and my mind said, that really looks good. Now, that's the truth. It did. There's no lie in it. It was the truth. And then my mind said, I bet that would taste good, too. And that was the truth. That's why she gave it to him. And it was not alcohol. It was red stuff. And then my mind said, I bet that'll make his whole dinner taste better. Of course it would. Then a prayer began in me. I did not begin praying. I didn't know I needed to pray. A prayer began in me. And I have learned over the years when that happens, and you'll know when it happens, I've retreated inside very quickly to listen. And became aware my very next thought would have been, I probably ought to have one of those. And it never would have been alcohol. I'm that close to danger. 25 years sober, in fit spiritual condition, and you weren't there. And I wasn't even aware I was in danger. I must be able to rely upon that during those strange mental blank spots where I am totally defenseless. And thank God I can trust in that. I'm sure there are other events in my life where that's occurred, but I don't even remember them. Okay? That serious to me. My mind will do me in. I don't want to use it for staying well. I use it on you or to play with the children, but I'm not using it to save my life. Okay? The great fact is this and nothing less. If we're going to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, the great fact is this, and nothing less than this. We've had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. I got a new mind. Revolutionized. That's strong talk. You hear that at meetings very often? I do. Because I talk about it at every meeting I go to. And I go to meetings where they talk about that. I don't want to learn to cope with life. I've got to have a whole new revolutionary change. It's got to be different from here on out. And part of the reason it has to be different is not just for me, it's for the new people. If I came to you smelly and dirty and using profanity constantly and full of negative attitude, and 2 years later I come to a meeting, and that's exactly what you look like, dirty and using profanity and full of negativity, and why in the hell would I stay? Okay, I needed to see somebody who'd been changed, or I wouldn't have stayed with you. I come from an old school. They made us put on coats and ties whenever we stood up and represented Alcoholics Anonymous, to show not only respect, but to indicate to people, I'm different. The only time I use profanity anymore is when it's almost a quote, although I do say shit once in a while. But that's a good word. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. My God is alive and well. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. And if you're seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. That's our common solution. In order to get to that, I had to throw out everything I believed about God. Everything. My sponsor just wiped them out. Made me sit there and talk to him about them. And then poo-pooed every one of them. I had nothing left. And I screamed at him, "You're asking me to turn my life over to the care of nothing." And he said, "Why not? Nothing can run it better than you've been doing it." True. I wanted so badly to be different. I had to die Christmas night because I couldn't stand being me anymore, and there was no more way for me to change. I had tried everything. I was in Dianetics when I was 19, right? I came out of the federal penitentiary and dove right into Dianetics. I knew L. Ron Hubbard. Now, that's a nice man, but let me tell you something. Somebody with a problem as serious as mine is, I turned my life and will over to the care of a science fiction writer. I better not think too good about this, huh? Lovely man, but that's what he is. He's a science fiction writer. My whole attitude about God had been, and I have to be careful not to get back into that, is, boy, do this for me. Oh, boy, where are you? You know when God's working? When I feel good. If I don't feel good, God's not working. What a crappy attitude that is. Huh? What is he, my servant? Rearrange his life so mine gets better. That's how I used to pray. God's not going to move your life around and make mine better. What a silly attitude that is. And these are the things that my sponsor and I went over. Gimme, 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 gimme. He's given me everything from the beginning of time. Okay. So, I had to have a revolutionary change in my thinking about spiritual things. And when I use the word God, I don't know any other word to use. I have no idea what it means. It just does seem to communicate somehow. But I had to have a revolutionary change from the basic attitude is, what is he going to do for me? My life depends on what am I going to do for him. That's a revolutionary change I cannot bring about myself because myself will not let go of self. It takes spiritual power to swing that around. What I've done in essence, the surrender at the third step in essence for me, is I've taken the keys to the car away from the five-year-old. I don't let him drive anymore. But I always take him on the trip. Now, don't ever take a long trip without a kid. They're the only ones who know how to have fun. Okay. We think we're supposed to get there. Kids know that the fun is in the getting there. Okay. I used to think when they said, "Are we there yet?" that they were impatient to get there. No, they were afraid we were there. And then the fun stops. Huh? It's about the journey. It's about the journey. I want to go over some things as we go about the fourth step. I'm not going to give you any details about how to do it. It's in the book. But I'm going to show you how I read the book when we get there. I want you to understand that I think the whole thing from the third step on is spiritual in nature. And I believe that for the, and I'm leading up to the fact that sometime this afternoon we're going to say the third step prayer. In spiritual terms, you got to learn to listen spiritually. Amen is a closure of a prayer. It means this particular spiritual activity is now closed, so be it. It's an affirmation that we have done this, and it's done and accomplished. It's over. And we're going to move into something else. There's no amen at the end of the third step prayer. Do you know what I'm saying? First one that shows up is at the end of what we call the seventh step prayer, which is the third step prayer with teeth in it. Okay. So I believe that everything from the Word God, from the invocation of the presence of God at the beginning of the third step to the amen at the end of the seventh step is all part of the prayer. Prayer is action and activity and far more than gimme, gimme, gimme. It's a spiritual activity. And so you're safe and protected and you can't do it wrong. Jerry.
All my, I was raised, by the way, in that little small Kansas town, with a very, in a very religious environment, and so I came in here full of ideas about the Spirit and about God and so on and so forth, and most of those ideas centered around if I was good, there was a payoff. Now that's the real simple way of saying it. If I was real good, I could get God to love me. That's the bottom line. Any of you ever said if you were good, you might go to heaven. If you're bad, you might go to hell? By the time I was 15, I knew I wasn't going to make it to heaven. But there was a real life-threatening message for this alcoholic mind contained in there, and that was that I had to, on my power, become good. And there's a problem with that, and that is I don't have the power to be good. One of my favorite little experiences, and I like to share it because it symbolizes my life, is we grew up and we weren't from a well-to-do family. And when I was 16 years old in Kansas in those days, this was 1957, you could get a full, unrestricted driver's license. And so my father, somehow, our lives began to change financially. And he had bought a new car that year, very first one we'd ever owned. And so I just pleaded with him. I said, you know, can I take that new car? I'd always trying to get a hold of the new car, and we had another old car, but I wanted to drive the new one. See, I thought I'd be cool if I could have that new one and drive up and down the streets. I know that none of you other guys have ever thought that if you're driving a nice car, you'll attract a girl. We think we're deep thinkers. But I did. I just badgered him and badgered him. Finally, one night, I said, you know, I'll run up. They needed something from the store, and I quickly volunteered. I'll go, see how nice I am? I'll do that. And I talked him into taking that new car, and it really was only 2 or 3 weeks old. And in this little town, you have to understand that it was 3 blocks up to the main street from where we lived, and it was 7 blocks down to the grocery store. And then, of course, 7 blocks back, make the turn at the Dairy Queen, go 3 blocks in your home. So I took that new car and I went up straight up the store just like I promised I would do, because I intended to do what I promised I would do. Drove right straight up to Main Street, made the left turn at the Dairy Queen, went to 7 blocks of store, turned back, and got to the Dairy Queen. Now, in these little towns out in Kansas, the Main Street where the stores are is also the highway. And so as I approached the Dairy Queen, all I have to do the right thing, which I promised I'll do, is turn right and go 3 blocks. And I'm home, and I have kept my commitment. To this day, I cannot tell you why, but I lacked the power to do the right thing. I knew the right thing to do, but I didn't have the power to do it. And I'll make this story short. I just thought driving out on the highway sounded cool. And then driving out by the drive-in and around on a gravel road sounded cool. And driving fast on a gravel road sounded even more cool. And that car and I ended up being in a little accident. It was never a new car again. But see, I really did intend to do the right thing when I asked him if I could drive that car. I really did. And that really symbolizes my whole life. I have never had the power to do the right thing for any sustained period of time. What little power I've had, I could maybe do the right thing for a short period of time, but then something goes haywire in my mind. I know today what it is I get totally self-absorbed. But as an alcoholic, I'm the only one who doesn't know that I'm self-absorbed. I still look at that today. I have a lot of fun with that. People used to say, Jerry, why did you do that? You know, if you do something stupid, and they say, why did you do that? And so you look at them right in their little baby blue eyes, and you give them a great explanation. And they look back and you say, Jerry, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard of in my life. And you think, why bother to explain? See, it took some of this reflection on the factual, not my experiences, but the facts of my life. Here are the facts of my life. People have been telling me as far back as I can remember, Jerry, you don't think right. But like I say, I'm the only one who doesn't know that I don't think right. People in right thinking don't do the things that I have done. And I'm delusional in that thinking. Let me give you a little example. One time, many years ago, a friend of mine, and I was in a fairly, well, I was important. Let's just be honest. I was damned important. And this guy needed what they call a contractor's performance bond. Statutes of limitations have run, so we're all right here. And he needed a performance bond, and so I helped him forge a bond. That's basically what I did. And it took a little artwork and some other stuff, but pretty tricky. Now, here's the delusional thinking about that whole thing. As I did all that and still believed that I was a grand guy. I mean, there was breaking and entering involved. A forgery was involved. Conspiracy to commit fraud was involved. And through that whole thing, I had this delusion that I was a grand guy. I was a grand guy. And you know what? During all that time, I was trying to be good. Now, that may sound strange to you. I didn't have any delusions about getting rich over this. I was going to be important, you understand. I was going to get some prestige out of it. But I wasn't going to be rich. But I didn't have the power to do anything else. And so along, then the drinking started, and I got into that same spot. There were times where I knew that I needed to do something about this drinking. And I was always, in Texas, they have a nice little expression. It's called, I'm a fixin' to